Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
Immediately the rumors started.
The mysterious death of a legendary sports star.
There's this massive landslide of myth.
Legend of Tahti.
And somewhere in there is the truth.
Part of Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Vishala Sripathma. On today's show, we'll be looking at the US economy. Fears of the R word, recession, is looming following some weak job numbers. Can a potential crisis be averted? We're live in New York. And it's over 200 years old, but it's on the brink of collapse. South Africa's postal service goes cap in hand to the government for a bailout. We speak to the man tasked with saving the age-old institution. Plus, what does Banksy artwork do to your house price? Well, our reporter speaks to some rather smug homeowners. Remember, you can email us at any time during the programme on world.business@bbc.co.uk, or you can send me a message on social media. I'm at BBC Vishala SP. So we start in the United States, where it's been a busy week for economic data. Today, we had some more news on jobs. Now, non-farm payrolls looks at jobs added each month from the private sector and government agencies. We had data on hiring in that sector today, and the number of jobs added in August in those industries hit 142,000, which is less than expected. It all points to what economists call a cooling of the labour market in the US, and it sparked concern that there could be a recession on the cards as well. Well, joining me now is our North America business correspondent, Ritika Gupta. Ritika, more disappointing news then about hiring.
Yes, Vishala. And as you mentioned, the jobs print for August missing estimates coming in at 142,000 jobs being added. They were expecting 160,000. There are also downward revisions to the prior month as well. Remember, July was that big disappointment. So that was actually worse than previously thought. But there is an upside that unemployment rate did tick down to 4.2%. So overall, it wasn't a terrible jobs report. And actually, that's what's complicating the debate even more of whether the Federal Reserve, when it meets later this month, that will cut borrowing costs by 25 or 50 basis points. And that was the big question. So clearly the labour market is softening, but the question really is about whether the Fed goes big later this month.
Yes, and that Federal Reserve meeting, it's coming quickly around the corner. Lots of pressure there and also lots of eyes on them and what they're going to be doing, as you just said.
Yes, indeed. Again, the question is whether there'll be 25 basis point or a 50 basis point. And this data, I mean, the Fed is now saying it's going to be focusing more on the other side of its dual mandate, which is full employment. That's as inflation has started to recede. But there are questions now about, you know, whether also is inflation, it's still definitely in the rearview mirror. I think what next traders are going to be looking at is Governor Christopher Wallace speaking and his comments, because right now, what traders were hoping would be a decisive report about one way or the other in terms of the size of the interest rate cut, it hasn't really given them that. So they'll be watching for his comments to see if they get a little bit more information.
Okay, Ritika, thank you for joining us. Ritika Gupta, our North America business correspondent in New York. Let's bring in our markets guest now for today, and that's Christopher Rosbach, who's Chief Investment Officer at J. Stern. Thanks for joining us, Christopher.
Thank you very much.
Christopher, we saw the Treasury yield curve move a fair bit yesterday after we had that labour data out from the US yesterday. And for those that don't know about the Treasury yield curve in the US, that's quite a key indicator of things like recessions, for example. What do you make of these numbers?
Well, I think we've had the labor data out today, but I think people have to take a perspective. We're still seeing the aftershocks of the pandemic. Like a stone you throw in a pond, the waves continue to oscillate. And the reality is, in the fairy tale, Goldilocks, the soft landing, the porridge is just right. But in reality, it's always too hot or too cold. And I think that's what we're seeing in these job reports. So while the number that's been reported today has been a little bit weak on the headline, you see that U.S. futures are actually resilient. I think it's showing a response by the markets that's in line with that. And the underlying jobs number is actually resilient. There are a few sectors that are showing actual declines in jobs. It's decelerating. That's what the Fed has been after. It means that there's less pressure on inflation. We've seen that there's 4.8% wage growth, which is a lot for the U.S., which is, after all, the largest economy in the world, which means that the scissors, the gap between inflation and wages, is narrowing. And so I think that the Fed has been able to engineer this. And I think we can look forward to a constructive session of the Fed when they come to announce the end of the interest rate cycles in a couple of weeks.
Yes, and we just touched with on that with Ritiker. So the Federal Reserve, the central bank in the United States, the governor of that bank, Jerome Powell, basically signaled that a rate cut was coming next time they meet. It was just a question of the size of the rate cut. What's your view of that?
Well, again, I think that the Fed has been managing these issues, I think, extremely well. We've been in a decade of central bank interventions. Jay Powell has announced that rate cuts are coming. It's going to be data-driven, language that we know since the 2000s of this era. And so I think that with this outcome that we've had, where we've had slightly disappointing growth numbers, but we've had resilient GDP, we've had resilient personal consumption in the last couple of weeks, I think it's more likely to be a moderate cut in line with that of 25 basis points rather than 50. But I think they're going to be very data driven and very careful in terms of continuing to manage the outcome for the U.S. economy.
Interesting, Christopher. We'll have to see if you're right in a couple of weeks' time. You're going to be with us throughout the show, Christopher Rosbach there. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Let's head to South Africa now, where the post office is on the brink of shutting down. Now, the post office, like in many countries, is over centuries old institution in South Africa, and many people there, including large swathes of the elderly and those on lower incomes, are really reliant on that service that they provide. Now, it got into financial trouble earlier this year, and the businesses had to employ some rescue practitioners that were brought in to try and sort it out. And they cut jobs and slimmed down the operations, but to no avail. The business is still in a lot of trouble, and the company's chief executive warned on Thursday that if the government doesn't pump billions into the state-owned company, it would fail. Well, Anoush Rooplal is one of the joint business rescue people that was tasked with saving the South African Post Office. I asked him what went wrong.
The South African Post Office was in financial distress around July last year. In fact, it was placed into provisional liquidation. The joint business rescue practitioners, which is myself and Mr. Juanito Diamonds, was appointed in order then to rescue the entity.
And that hasn't gone too well, has it? Because you're having to go to the government to ask for help.
It's actually gone very well in terms of what the business rescue practitioners had to implement. I think what's not going well now is the anticipated receipt of the funding that was supposed to have been received.
So okay, hang on, but it can't have gone too well because 4,000 people have lost their jobs. So, I mean, how did that happen?
So our task is to put up a business rescue plan that would restore the entity and bring it back to profitability and so on. And unfortunately, the retrenchments of 4,000 people was part of the cost reduction exercise in order to optimize the business again.
Okay, so you cut 4,000 jobs, but it's still wasn't working, that the business is still failing?
Well, the business rescue plan was split into two parts. It was always indicated that two tranches of funding would be received. The second tranche of the money, that was supposed to have been forthcoming about 6 months ago. So that's where the challenges come by.
So that second lot of money, you feel, will fix all the problems?
It'll certainly go a long way to upgrading critical infrastructure, but more importantly, allowing us to diversify revenue streams into other areas where the post office has unfortunately been slow to, you know, get into.
So my understanding is the post office is a very important institution in people's lives in South Africa. Elderly people are reliant on it for their welfare payments, for example. If you're having to make these job cuts, who are going to do the sort of crucial jobs of deliveries or whatever jobs that have gone in their absence?
Unfortunately, the workforce, it was a bloated workforce. And, you know, that was the first aspect of achieving efficiencies. Right now, we still have 6,200 people. And in terms of the agile business model that we're working towards, we believe that that is still a sufficient number of staff to maintain and improve service delivery. We have about 31% of the South African population that lives in rural areas. And that's where the strength of the post office is in terms of our social infrastructure. We have post office branches in all of the rural areas so that we can service South Africans in these areas.
It doesn't feel like the company or South Africa post office has been keeping the government up to date, because it was a bit of a bombshell, wasn't it, when the interim chief executive told parliamentarians that the company had effectively run out of cash?
So the requirement for funding was always there upfront, and it was common cause that the first tranche of money could only go so far. As you are aware, we've had a new change of administration, a government in South Africa, and this was our only chance or our first chance to present an update on the affairs of the SA Post Office, and which we had duly done. And as far as keeping our shareholder and National Treasury updated, you know, we've endeavoured to keep them updated on a monthly or a regular basis.
Well, they don't seem to think so, though. They've said it was far more serious than they'd expected.
Yeah, I suppose the portfolio committee comprises of different members, not necessarily residing, you know, at the shareholder or National Treasury. So there are different representatives as well in those structures.
And so do you think you're going to get this bailout that you need?
Well, the intentions are that there is still support for the SA Post Office because it is a national asset that's been around for over 200 years.
That was Anoush Ruplal. The Japanese owner of the convenience store chain 7-Eleven has rejected a $38 billion takeover bid from a Canadian rival. Now, 7-I Holdings said the offer was grossly undervaluing the company. For the Japanese, the value of 7-Eleven isn't just about the business, though. It's got huge cultural significance, and also one can be found on most street corners in the cities. As River Davis, a reporter for New York Times in Tokyo, explained to me earlier on.
In Japan, the convenience store, as it's called in Japanese, konbini, is often called a national treasure. They are kind of a big part of the society's infrastructure here. They have a ton of fresh food, around 3,000 products per store. And people really rely on them for a number of their day-to-day activities. You can pay your bills there. You can pick up government documents and packages. So there's a really large kind of repeater base for these convenience stores, such as 7-Eleven. Frequently, you talk to people that, you know, will step inside a 7-Eleven for various purposes, 3-4 times a day even. So they're really kind of held in high regard in Japan.
And this takeover bid, not entirely surprising that takeover bids of Japanese companies are now kind of coming to the surface, given what the yen is doing. Why was it rejected?
So the independent board that 7-I, the operator of 7-Eleven, set up to examine this deal replied in a letter to Kushtar sent earlier today, saying basically that the deal grossly undervalued 7-Eleven's value as a company. So management is trying to project to shareholders that it is capable of increasing the value of 7-Eleven without kind of accepting a bid from Kushtar. The other problem that they flagged with Kushtar's takeover bid is they think that it could likely face regulatory issues in the United States because 7-Eleven and Kushtar are actually the largest convenience operators in that country.
Do you think that this still has legs in it, or do you think it might open the door for other companies to come along and think they might be able to get a bit of the 7-Eleven action?
This does certainly open the door, perhaps not for another takeover bid, although Couche-Tard could come back with a more kind of lucrative offer. But certainly 7-Eleven has been under pressure for years from activist shareholders that have said that it suffers from conglomerate discount, meaning that all of the businesses that it has together are worth less than they really should be. So they've faced pressure from some activists to really focus just on the 7-Eleven convenience store brand and kind of do away with other businesses that it owns, such as, you know, supermarket chains in Japan. So certainly, I think going forward, 7-Eleven management will face a lot more pressure to kind of reorganize its business and show shareholders that it's taking steps to really increase its corporate value. And that's been a broader trend that we've seen amongst Japanese companies broadly over the past few years. Regulators here in Tokyo have really pushed companies to put a higher priority on returning value to shareholders than they have in the past.
When was the last time you went to a 7-Eleven?
I have to say, I literally went to 7-Eleven for lunch today to pick up a salad. I was filing a couple stories and I didn't have time to cook. And it just shows you how widely we all rely on these 7-Elevens for fresh food.
Never too far away from a 7-Eleven in Japan, it seems. So the yen is slightly up today against the dollar. Let's bring back in Christopher Ross back. Christopher, another big company move at the moment that's going on is Japan's Nippon Steel's bid to take over US Steel, except Joe Biden, the US president, says he's going to block that move.
Well, look, I think given what we've just heard, it goes both ways, right? You can have Canadian in this case, but U.S. companies trying to take up over Japanese companies. It's the biggest potential foreign takeover of any Japanese company, and there's considerations there. And likewise, you can have Japanese companies taking over U.S. companies. In the case of Japan, the yen is at a low, as we've heard, and as we know, and so it's quite opportunistic. But in the case of steel, it's equally opportunistic because these industrial companies are bombed out. There's a great concern around it. There's been a need for consolidation in the industry. There's been a need for investment. And there are some operators out there like Nippon Steel that have a great deal of efficiency. So I think it's only natural that the market will try to set prices for these public companies in both cases. And it's a real challenge, I think, to the U.S., to free trade and to an election year to see what the government's going to do about it.
Okay, Christopher, thank you very much. And U.S. steel up at the moment about 4.6%. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. Well, let's stay in the U.S. because YouTube is to limit recommendations of certain health and fitness videos to teenagers, including those which idealize certain body types. It says 13 to 17 year old users will still be able to search for and view fitness related content, but will not be encouraged to repeat view similar videos, so effectively rejigging its algorithm. Experts have welcomed the measure, but say it needs to be accompanied by a broader discussion about fitness and health for young people. Well, Dr. Petia Eckler is a senior lecturer at the University of Strathclyde. I asked her why YouTube had decided to take this decision now after years of lobbying.
I hope that the policymakers on the YouTube have finally realized the potential risks that some online content can pose to some people, especially young people in their teenage years can be a lot more susceptible to content that relates to their bodies. And so I hope that the evidence that the research community has presented, the advocacy that many parents and charities have done in recent years, I'm hoping that part of that has played a role in this decision by YouTube to change their policy in this regard.
Do you think it's going to have the desired impact?
I hope so. But then the caveat here is that there are many other users who don't register and use YouTube, or maybe misrepresent how old they are. So then what's going to help those users to not fall into those same rabbit holes, as they're often called, in terms of online content? in terms of the actual users that it may capture, the ones that are registered and are really teenagers, yes, the idea here is that less targeted content of the same topic, in this case of idealized body pictures and videos, that would hopefully reduce the pressure on these young people to follow these very rigid and tight standards and to try by any means possible to fit into them.
Okay. And in terms of the kind of wider question about social media, this is something perhaps out of the hands of social media and tech companies, that actually there needs to be a bit more regulation of what teenagers and young people view online, and that perhaps falls in the home.
Yes. I have been a proponent of more regulations of content through social media, simply because there's plenty of evidence already, both research-based evidence, anecdotal evidence just based on people's individual experiences, where content has been harmful. And social media companies make enough profits off of this content. They need to also take the responsibility for it. Back in the day, they used to claim they're not media companies, although they share media content. We need to move beyond that, and there needs to be more responsibility on their part.
Have you seen any situations where you've seen how it impacts young people in terms of body image?
Well, absolutely. I'm currently in the process of collecting data through interviews with young people. And we talk about whether they use social media, what social media channels they use. We then, unrelated to that, talk about how they feel about themselves. And inevitably, the links between the content they see on social media and how they feel about their bodies, those links come up without being pushed by me as the researcher. Those links come up organically and naturally by these young people themselves.
What happens to these individuals, the people that you've spoken to through your studies and your work? What are the consequences?
A lot of these young people talk about just societal pressure, peer pressure that they feel to look a certain way, to be slim and to fit a certain expected standard of beauty. That often cannot happen just by living a healthy lifestyle and being active. So often, you know, we see uses of slimming teas or even other excessive practices. So overall, on the most probably widespread and most innocent level, is just this idea of the incessant pressure of looking a certain way, behaving a certain way, showing off all that to others. For these young people, we have to understand that goes together with all the other pressures that they have in life. The pressure to perform in school, the pressure to live your life in a way that your peers approve of. So it's a very high risk period for many young people, these teenage years. And when we add the sometimes toxic influence of social media, things can go even more serious. So I wouldn't say that we should stay away from social media. I think we've lost that battle already, but there should definitely be more moderation in terms of the content that is shared and how much it's used by young people.
Dr. Petya Eckler there. We're going to end with a little bit of culture, because when world-renowned street artist Banksy went on a painting spree in London recently, it became a huge tourist attraction. But what does it mean for the local economies and communities for those areas where he chooses to make his mark? The BBC's Sarah Rogers has been following the mystery artist's work around London to find out.
What makes anything worth what's worth? I mean, whatever someone's willing to pay. Got one at the end of my road. Has it increased the value of my flat? I'm not sure.
Priceless. Any artist is good for attracting people and populating cities.
You can't move it, so it's priceless, I suppose. It's just cool for everybody to see it.
Cool to see for free, but there's no doubt the elusive Banksy is a very bankable artist. If you ask a lot of people to name an artist, often they can name Banksy. So when 9 pieces featuring animals, including elephants, a rhino and even a cat, appeared sprawled across London, they brought in the crowds.
Wow.
I'm following their trail to find out how the wow factor is financially impacting the areas they've been left in.
The next station is Moorgate.
First, historic Guildhall Yard, where there's piranhas painted on a police box. Madeline White from Hang Up Gallery is a Banksy specialist.
Culturally, he's incredibly valuable, and it enters people's lives in a way that it might not if it were hidden away in a gallery.
It's not hidden away, but the local authority, the City of London Corporation, have snapped up the Piranha Police box, moving it outside one of its galleries. Culture Chairman Munsur Ali.
We decided to move it here for the public good, to protect it. We're not in the business to support graffiti art.
We don't support graffiti art, but we want to protect and support Banksy. Why is that?
I knew you were going to ask that one. We've had 2,000 people come over here. I'm hoping those 2,000 people will go and then have a coffee at our local coffee shops and increase business for the local businesses.
OK, so is that happening? Let's head to the tourist area of Brick Lane. It's full of shops and global cuisine and a Banksy. Three monkeys swinging across a railway bridge. There's even a tour group as we arrive.
Is that Banksy?
We just walked down the street and it was there.
So you didn't intentionally come to this area to look for
it? No, we've come for bagels.
So is it boosting business?
Yeah, people, they stop there, they take a photo and pass. That's it.
A lot of people comes here, they lay on the stairs, they sit on the stairs. It's not good for the business.
But if you're off the tourist beat, like pub owner Mark, the Banksy depicting a rhino mounting a car 5 minutes from his pub is very welcome.
It's bought a nice weekday lunchtime trade. Thank you very much. Please put one on the side of our wall.
So who does own the wall? And does it technically make it theirs? The rhino, which has already been defaced now, is on an industrial area southeast of the city in Greenwich, owned by the council, who are facing big budget cuts. So might this help? Here's Councillor Anne-Marie Cousins.
We still don't know what's going to happen with this, so we're still thinking about possibilities.
Other councils have removed it from walls like this, sold it.
Oh, I think all local authorities go through this. You sort of think, oh, God, can we sell it? Can we leave it in situ? Would a museum want it? Would a rich buyer want it? We just, you know, all the ideas are up in the air, but we're still thinking about what's realistic or not.
So when Banksy works, people are keen to get a piece of it. In fact, a wolf in a satellite dish was stolen within an hour. The scramble to protect, sell or even steal them means they are undoubtedly seen as assets. Perhaps not quite what the artist famous for being anti-consumerist intended.
Indeed. I thought I had a bit of Banksy artwork on my road, but it was a fake, a wannabe Banksy, which was rather disappointing. That's it for World Business Report. Don't forget to download our podcast. You can follow me on my socials. I'm at BBC Vishala SP. Thanks for listening.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where is the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast, but we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.